Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, I've had a busy week, back in edit, ready for my next programme, but we've got to finish this one first. What's your week been like, Nazir?
As you probably know, I do some work as the chair of safeguarding for the Catholic Church. So I've been working with cardinals, bishops, victims, survivors to try and understand the complexity of the church, but also ultimately to introduce new standards by which they have to ensure that safeguarding is carried out. It's a mammoth task, Mark, but one that I'm thoroughly enjoying because there's a real appetite for change.
I think there is an appetite. I mean, I've arrested a lot of people in the church. I've also done an independent review for a diocese in the Catholic Church. But there is now a definite attitude from cardinals down for change, isn't there?
From the Pope down. I think reputationally, they have taken such a knock, and quite rightly so. And I think they realize that this is Last Chance Saloon. So I'm happy to be part of Last Chance Saloon.
Brilliant. Good. Well, today we are going to talk about Savile. He's back in the news again with a forthcoming BBC drama that's going to come out, Savile himself is being played by Steve Coogan. But let's set the scene in terms of Savile. Born James Wilson Vincent Savile, during his lifetime he was awarded an OBE, a knighted, born on the 31st of October 1926, and a very well-known English DJ and TV radio personality, best known for shows Top of the Pops and Jim Will Fix It, and over his lifetime, estimated £40 million raised for charity, massively involved with Stoke Mandeville Hospital, Leeds General Infirmary, and Broadmoor. He died on the 29th of October 2011, founded his home 2 days before his 85th birthday. That is when things started to change, albeit not immediately. There was outpouring of sympathy and grief for his funeral, wasn't there?
Well, there's more than that. I think wasn't there hope that there might be some kind of state funeral for him because of how big a figure he was. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of celebrities came out and showed their love for him, which I think they regret big time now. And if you remember, there was an enormous tombstone built in that cemetery to perhaps reflect his personality, which ultimately was taken down once the allegations came. But, he was a big figure, a very powerful figure, and clearly that had a part to play in the abuse that he carried out.
And I think it's difficult perhaps for the younger generation just to imagine how big a famous individual he was. But let's go back to his era. BBC One, BBC Two and ITV, there was no Channel 4. There was no Channel 5. There wasn't Sky. There wasn't all these other channels. So there were simply three channels and two broadcasters, ITV and BBC. He was at the forefront of the BBC. He was in everyone's living room on a Saturday evening with Jim Will Fix It. He was there with Top of the Pops. This was a man who, as close as, walked on water.
Yeah, 15 million, 20 million viewers a week. The Jim Will Fix It program, for those who don't remember, was people writing in and he would, quote unquote, make their dreams come true. And there were tens of thousands of letters every week, mainly from children, which we now know should have alerted a lot of people. But the point is, he was as big a figure in British media as anybody has ever been.
He was huge. He was huge. And actually, that says a lot, and we'll unpick it in relation to why he was never challenged. Because there were signs. There were multiple signs during his lifetime in his early days. And you go back to 1978, the Sex Pistol Joe Lydon said very clearly that he would like to kill Jimmy Savile. He talked about him being a hypocrite. He said that he had things going on in his life, seediness, and that he'd heard lots of rumours about him. But he felt that this information was never going to get out. And indeed, he was right.
I think worse than that, Lydon and others who did speak up were blacklisted. So they weren't given any more work because they had challenged the institutional view that Savile was the saint that they thought he was. And so if you did speak out, there were repercussions and there was victimization and there was consequences. And so is it no wonder that the victims never spoke out?
Savile dies in October 2011, but there was a significant event that occurred in 2007 that nobody knew about until this period of time. And that related to a criminal allegation, didn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I was at the Crown Prosecution Service then. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but in 2007, allegations were made by three women to Surrey Police, one woman to Sussex Police, going back several decades against Jimmy Savile. He was interviewed under caution. He basically said that these women were making it up. They were after his money, quote unquote. And the police decided to, first to take it no further, but they showed it to the Crown Prosecution Service, who agreed with them that they felt there was no realistic possibility of conviction. And the basis for that was that these women would not be believed by a court. Now, the problem with that, or many problems with that, is that it was reviewed again a couple of year or so after Savile's death by Alison Levitt QC. At that time, I was very much aware of it. And Alison came to the conclusion that there were so many failings in that investigation. The most biggest, the biggest one, Mark, was that none of the victims who allegedly would not support a prosecution at the time had been told that there were other victims. So they were, they felt alone. They, you know, they were up on their own against Jimmy Savile, Sir Jimmy Savile, you know? And is it no wonder that they felt scared about coming forward? Now, had the police told each other victim that there's another victim or another victim, hopefully, or, you know, traditionally what happens, it emboldens the victim to feel that they're not alone and they can therefore go and give their evidence and be supported as they do by other accounts. But because that never happened, they felt they couldn't support a prosecution. So that was the that was the biggest failing, I think. But yeah, at the end of the day, Alison came to the conclusion, which we all now agree with, that there was a realistic possibility of conviction and that Savile should have been prosecuted in his lifetime.
And what I found interesting about that, and of course we now know about it because of the information that subsequently made its way into the public domain, and in fact we found out about it for our programme, which was that the police, when they interviewed Savile, they interviewed him at Stoke Mandeville. They didn't inform Stoke Mandeville authorities that they were going to interview him there. Savile had a room there. And they interviewed him purely on the basis that he was going to provide an account. He was named as a suspect in an indecent assault. They went to his place of work without telling his place of work he was going there, and they interviewed him. And the interview was appalling because, in essence, what they allowed the interview to do, or the interviewee to do, was to control the interview. Savile basically threatened them and said, you know, if you're going to pursue this, I will bring all the weight of the legal elements down on you. Yeah.
I mean, I think he told them that he'd sued five newspapers previously or something, which, you know, he may or may not have done. But the point is, literally, he was scaring and did successfully scare off the investigators who already went in there, really literally, bent over backwards to accommodate him. But additionally, once they became threatened by him, rather than see that as, something they should investigate further, they chose to simply back off.
And in fact, they did nothing with the information that he gave them. We had the accounts from the ladies. They put the accounts to Savile. Savile gave his response, which was, in essence, I've never been there. They're talking rubbish. Had he have gone to Duncroft, because it's all related to Duncroft, had he have gone to Duncroft, the approved school, and spoken to the headmistress there, she would have told them exactly what the girls had said in terms of being there the times to be true.
Absolutely.
And it would have proved that Savile was lying. But they didn't do any of those inquiries. And I don't want to be too subjective to the officers themselves, but let's talk in general terms. I think they were in awe of the whole situation.
Yeah. I mean, they were reflective of the whole landscape in relation to power and control at that time. You know, their view was this man was so powerful. We talked earlier on about even celebrities speaking up against him were blacklisted. So can you imagine if a police officer spoke up against him or a victim spoke up against him, what the repercussions may follow there? They were in awe of him. They were scared of him. He had the legal support, he had obviously institutional support, and the police just did not do their job properly, and the prosecutors did not do their job properly, which is why he never received justice in his lifetime.
So there were rumours that started to come out fairly soon after his death, and I obviously then ended up down the line fairly shortly having a very significant role. Let me just give you a slight insight into that, much of it's widely recorded. But I was going over to Interpol. I was doing some filming actually for BBC Newsnight, and I was doing a film on child abuse material at Newsnight. And on the way back, Marion Jones, who was my producer, and he said to me, "Mark, have you ever heard anything about Jimmy Savile being a child sex offender?" And I said, "No." I said, "He's a weird bloke and I wouldn't want him anywhere near my kids. But yeah, I know I've never heard that." And he said, apparently he was arrested by either Surrey or Sussex police. And I went, "I've not heard that." I said, "That's strange, because I'm surprised I haven't heard it if it was Surrey police that arrested him." Anyway, we get back and he said, "Look, we're looking to do a program on him, but..." And at that stage, he hadn't died. He said, "We're looking to do a program on him, but we won't be able to do it at this stage because no one will broadcast it whilst he's alive." Anyway, fairly shortly after that, he does die. Marion Jones phones me up and says, "We're now doing a program. He's dead." I said, "Brilliant." And they said, "You know, would you contribute to the program as an expert in this field?" And I said, "Yeah, no problems at all." And so that was kind of where we were. They went off and did their inquiries, and they had one woman that was telling them about allegations at the BBC and informing them about abuse that had taken place at Duncroft. It was all centered around Duncroft, and that was very much because Mari Jones' relative was working there. The BBC subsequently decided, and I've got an email from passed to me from the BBC, where in essence, it had been established, I'd established for them, that it was Surrey Police that did an investigation. And the editor decided basically that it wasn't a story unless they could show the police failings. And I remember saying, and I've said this every single time I talk about it, is that he got that so wrong, because the story was Jimmy Savile was a child sex offender, not whether the police made a mistake. That was secondary. The story was that Jimmy Savile was a child sex offender.
Wasn't he interested in the BBC's failures?
No, not at all. I mean, this is what ended up happening, was that the BBC completely and utterly closed ranks and did not know what to do. And I know when we made our programme, one of the things that we did is we wrote, as you do, to those individuals who are in a programme who you're going to be critical of. Mm. And we call it a right to reply. And we gave a right to reply to the BBC. In fact, we asked George Entwistle, who was the Director General at the time, for an interview in relation to these allegations. Anyway, he refused an interview. And the BBC, in essence, came back and said, we've got no comment to make in any way at all. And, you know, in essence, we don't believe these allegations. They did later change their stance once it all was massive in the headlines. And on the morning of the broadcast, I actually had to go in and do a re-record because they'd issued a new right to reply. But the point of it was that had the BBC acknowledged that it is possible that this could have occurred, but at the very least, we will investigate it, rather than close rank and shut the door, the outcome would have been very different.
No, absolutely, 100%. I think, you know, as a matter of public record, the BBC weren't keen on, well, at a management level, weren't keen on doing the programme at Newsnight, which is why, it had ended up with the ITV and with you, Mark. But the issue clearly was whether or not Savile, or there's no whether or not about it, that Savile was an abuser of children and had been for several decades. But for whatever reason, they just simply wanted to focus on some kind of institutional failure rather than which one then would be a failure of everybody around him. And I think this is the thing about people closing ranks, is that silence might buy you time, but it doesn't at the end of the day work. If you remember you obviously remember because you were part of it. The reality is that it became an even bigger story, I think, because of the way it was handled, particularly by the BBC during that first year.
The Director General resigns and it takes on a life of its own. And I remember the eve of our programme going out, a very senior individual at ITV said to me, I had a meeting with a very senior director at the BBC and said to them, are you slightly nervous about this programme going out? And the BBC director said, no, we don't think it'll come to anything. Yeah, it didn't come to anything, apart from the fact that it ran on the front pages of all the national headlines for 40, but near national papers for 41 consecutive days. You know, that's phenomenal. I don't think there's any other story
that could run that long. A real lack of awareness. Did they think it would be like a, you know, fly by night story, you know, here today, gone tomorrow? We were talking about Jimmy Savile here. You know, maybe they'd forgotten how big a figure they had made him, you know, by giving him the platforms that they did and the extent of the abuse. I mean, it was often called on an industrial scale, but that belittles it really, because we're talking about a generation of women and girls that he's had, and boys for that matter, that he's had contact with, that he sexually assaulted, that he damaged. And, you know, they're still living
with
that.
There was so much nervousness around it. I mean, even with ITV, you know, when I started the program for ITV and we started to make it, and you know, Marion Jones was very helpful. He gave us a couple of the individuals that they'd spoken to. But I said to Marion and to the team, to our team, is that basically we had to take it away from Duncroft. We had to find independent people away from Duncroft, because otherwise the public would just simply say, well, these girls can't be believed. They're not credible. You know, they come from an approved school. And then sadly, that was often a mentality that people had.
Yeah. You blame the victims.
We had to bolster their story by having other people. And we started to find them. And at one stage, ITV said, you know, keep finding more victims. And I said to them, how many do you want? How many do you have to have before this program gets to air? And the nervousness around this was that, and I've kind of spoken about it, but not in real detail, is that I, for the period of the time, for the whole program, and that's close to a year before we got to broadcast, is I did not get paid a penny. I didn't have a contract because they didn't want to commission the program. So the program wasn't even commissioned. It was basically made uncommissioned and then put into edit uncommissioned. And then once it was finished and everyone said, okay, let's go for it, it was effectively commissioned at point of program.
Isn't that unusual?
Made.
I mean, that sounds very
unusual
to me.
No, exceptional. It's never happened.
Why do you think? Because it was such a hot potato.
Yeah, such a hot potato. I mean, it was a hot potato. You know, hats off to Kevin Ligo and to Alex Gardner, who did stay with it. You know, those are the two, you know, one's an exec producer, one was the former head of TV. You know, they were behind it, but there was a nervousness beyond. I mean, there was a number of stages I thought this program is never going to get broadcast. And even at some stages, I spoke to my producer, Leslie Gardner, and we'd often speak on the way in the tube and say, what are we going to do if they just pull the plug on this? Can we get it out? Can we fund it ourselves? Can we find somebody? Can we find someone who's a financier to fund this? That was that. Well, we lived that for months and months and months. I remember my mum saying to me, Mark, do you really think you should be doing this program? You know, he was such a well-known person. And I said, well, you know, I know that he's done things wrong. And yes, I've got to do it.
Is that because you were dashing people's childhoods? Yes. You know, we grew up with this man in the way that he was or perceived to be, and that actually you were destroying the image that we had of him by doing this program.
And I even get that now. You know, I think there's no doubt. There's a ITV exec said to me a couple of months ago, Mark, you know, you are still getting the fallout, and you'll get more fallout from exposing Savile. There are people out there who really dislike you for a number of reasons.
Just on that, Mark, because I was taken aback by some of the publicity around the 10th anniversary of his death, which focused very much on the BBC journalists, who did a great job. You know, there's no getting away from it. They did a great job. But it seemed to erase you from history. I mean, I those of us who obviously know about this case and know how it's been reported and how ultimately it delivered the change, know that you were heavily involved in that. But pretty much the publicity around the 10th anniversary seemed to focus entirely on the BBC's investigation, rather than the fact at the end of the day it was your investigation that brought it to the public knowledge.
Yeah, it's a very hard one. You know, I try to let my programs speak for themselves. You let the content tell the story rather than the story become me. And there is this, and I'm sure you're alluding to the Guardian article, which is very much where a lot of this information has come from, and others have been picked up on it. Certainly the BBC ran about it. And there is no doubt that the work of Marion and Liz Jones was crucial to start people asking questions about Jimmy Savile. But the information they had and the witnesses they had formed probably actually tiny part of our program. We simply have gone with their witnesses, I genuinely don't believe that we'd have exposed him, because it was very weak and it only related to Duncroft. There were no independent witnesses. We took it much further than that, and it was an incredible amount of work. Now, I think it's a really difficult one, because one has to have balance in this. Is that I call myself the vehicle to exposure. But the reality was, the very people that made this happen were the victims.
No,
the victims who gave me their voice.
It always irks me when people say, oh, Nazir, you're really courageous, or Mark, you were really courageous. No, the only people courageous in anything that we've ever dealt with, you and I, are the people who stood up and said, I was hurt, I was harmed, absolutely, I suffered, my family suffered. You know, nobody can underestimate. A lot of people just don't understand how, you know, you're burdened with secrets when you're the abuse victim. You are told that nobody will ever believe you. You're meant to think that you're to blame for whatever it is that happened. When they suddenly get the courage, and it is extraordinary courage, to come up and say, look, this is what happened to me, against somebody powerful of the type of Jimmy Savile, I can't begin to tell you how courageous that is. You know, we're just, we're just conduits. You know, the way in which they are able to tell their story.
It is the power of the victims that enable us to tell the story. It's as simple as that. You know, I pulled it all together. I managed to make it in such a way that allowed their story to be told. But they were the brave ones. They were the ones that finally allowed it. And it's thanks to those women that appeared in the program and gave their testimony that allowed the landslide to happen. And I remember, after the back of the program, so the program goes out, was put out at just after 11 o'clock. And I remember that afternoon I'd actually done, the day before I'd done an interview on the Radio 4 media show. And the director from the BBC was there, and actually he got a really hard time. And I did feel slightly sorry for him, because he was entering kind of a bit of a dragon's den, really, because when he got in there, of course, he didn't know the story well enough and he didn't know all the background. And Steve Hewitt at the time was a very good interviewer, the late Steve Hewitt. And he gave him a really big drill. And in fact, it's interesting, just prior to going into that interview, the ITV press office had asked me to do that interview for a number of days. And I said, yes, I'll do it. Anyway, the about 15 minutes before, the press office phoned up and said, Mark, we're a little bit worried about this interview, because, you know, Steve Hewitt, it's a really good interview, and we're a bit worried that he's going to try and have you over the coals. And I went, that's probably not the best thing to tell me 15 minutes just before I go and do an interview.
What were they scared of, though? You were going to tell them what the victims already told you. I mean, what were they scared of?
Well, I think they were scared in probably just because it was such a hot potato. But actually, you know, I handled all the media myself throughout all of those stages, and nothing ever came off. It all went very, very smoothly. And obviously the program goes out, and I went silent for 2 weeks. And I tell you, I went silent. I didn't do any media. I got lots of requests to do interviews and medias after the program. And I went silent for 2 weeks because I just let it happen. I let everyone else carry on with their bits. I let the story grow and the story go off on its tangents, which was the BBC, Stoke Mandeville, Broadmoor. I'd started that in terms of being the conduit through the victims, and I let the story go. And I remember Nikki Campbell phoned me up and he said, Mark, come on, come and do an interview. I said, no. I said, for 2 weeks, no, I'm not doing it. Anyway, finally phoned me up, said, Mark, will you come on and just talk in terms of the witnesses? You don't need to talk about anything else. Just talk in terms of victims. I said, I'll do that. Anyway, I broke my silence 2 weeks on. But the reason I didn't do it is because the story had to then become itself, and it did, you know, and it was then for the institutions to answer how they behaved, the likes of Broadmoor, the likes of Stoke Mandeville, And of course, it gave an opportunity for those so many victims to come forward. And I was,
we haven't touched upon it, but there was the review, the government authorized review by Dame Janet, which I think identified hundreds of victims over several decades. Talked about, you know, him being given his own room at Stoke Mandeville with his own key and. You know, it's still, when I think about it, sends shivers down my spine. You know, the culture that he created, the environment that he created was ridiculously unsafe. And, you know, the point is that people knew, or people turned a blind eye even when they did know. And, you know, their culpability, you know, I don't know how they can live with themselves, to be honest. You know, you look at some of the stories of the children and how they've had to live with lifelong trauma as a result of what happened to them. And there was another adult who could have stepped in and stopped it. Again, I say, I don't know how they can live themselves.
I remember I was at a game of rugby on a Sunday morning, and my agent phoned me and she said to me, David Gray, Superintendent David Gray from has set up Operation New Tree, and he wants to talk to you as soon as possible. Can you phone him? So I phoned him up and he said, Mark, can we come and see you as soon as possible tomorrow? Can I bring my team to see you? I said, yeah, of course you can. I'll get my team together. So we met up on the 16th floor at ITV on the Monday, and he came into the room, and I got to know David very well after that point. But David sat there and he said, I've been asked by the Metropolitan Police to do a scoping exercise in relation to Jimmy Savile to see if there are victims out there. And we reckon there's probably around 30, 35 victims. And I said, David, 500.
Where did they get that figure from? I mean, is it just plucked from the air or something?
I don't know. I said, more like 500. I said, you know, I've been investigating him for a year, and I can tell you, I can give you a list of those people. And there are many, many more. But let me just tell you about this. So you would think, wouldn't you, that Dame Janet Smith, who does her investigation and review, as part of that, is in order to gather the information, you would go to the people who'd investigated him, who had been had collected evidence, wouldn't you?
You'd expect that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. The BBC did, they put out a big advert saying, if you have got any information about Savile, please contact us. Anyway, and I waited for Dame Janet Smith or her team to contact me, thinking, oh, they'll contact me because, you know, I've got quite a lot of information I can give them because, you know, the way television programs are made is that I've only got 47 minutes to put my information on screen. So there will be lots and lots of other information that doesn't get on screen. Mm. And obviously there was also legal issues that sit behind that. Anyway, nothing. So I thought, I'll contact the solicitors for Dame Janet Smith and just say to them, I'm somewhat surprised you haven't been in contact. I've got a lot of information you might be interested in. Anyway, the response I got was, well, we're not sure you've got anything of any value to give us.
How do they know that?
And I said, are you serious? I said, do you not know what I've done? I said, how do you not know without asking me? And in fact, I had a bit of a disagreement with the person who did the review of Broadmoor, because I said to them, you need to speak to this person. And they said, well, we don't think they've got any information. I said, I know they've got information, but you don't know what information someone's got until you talk to them. I said, that is how investigations work. I said, but anyway, Dame Janet Smith. So I'm sat in the room with Dame Janet Smith, and in the end, we got on okay. And I said to Dame Janet Smith, before I start, I am after an apology. And I'm after an apology and acceptance from you that your failure to talk to me does not show me with great confidence that you've entered this investigation with an open view to talk to as many people as possible. I said, if you are telling me, given what I did, that you don't think I have anything to say, then who else have you told that to? When someone else makes contact with you.
What was the response to that?
Well, the solicitor, who I didn't like at all, was very rude. And I said, well, you know, I think you're utterly useless. But to Dame Janet Smith, she did acknowledge it. I have to say, she said, now I've heard what you've got to say. You know, I gave evidence for about 2.5 hours, 3 hours, very detailed evidence. And she said, well, thank you very much. She said, I apologize. We got it wrong.
It's a grave misunderstanding of what the media does. I think that they probably think, hang on a minute, we've seen his 47 minutes. That's it. He won't have anything else. He won't know anymore. They just have this view that you don't carry out the research that you did. You know, they don't have any proper understanding of what it takes to do an investigative program.
I had so much more information. In fact, Dame Janet Smith said to me, obviously we're talking about him, I said, let me tell you, I'm going to tell you all the information I've got about Saville. And I know, given your parameters of your investigation, some of this will fall outside of it. But I'm going to tell you, and the reason I'm going to tell you is I think your parameters are too narrow. And if I don't tell you, then nobody will have this information. I've given it to the police already, but it's important that you get it because some of it doesn't relate to something that anything that they can do from a criminal point of view. Hence why I gave them everything. I've got pages and pages of additional information that relate to it that I gave to the BBC, who did very well. She did nothing with it in any way at all.
I mean, look, as I said to you, I pay tribute to what you did, but more importantly, to the victims that you gave a voice to, who otherwise would not have been heard. The reality is that, Dame Janet's inquiry ultimately didn't put a full stop on this, but did give us a much better picture about what needs to happen. And what needs to happen, of course, is that people in power, people who are celebrities, should be applied the same test to them as to your next door neighbor or the person who lives down the street. You know, just because they are powerful people does not give them any greater right. They should be treated, for example, what you said about the interview taking place in his workplace without the workplace knowing, you know, that's nonsense. He should be, at a police station in Surrey being properly investigated under caution with a legal advisor. The investigation should have followed immediately afterwards. All of that should happen regardless of who you are. The moment we start saying there's a certain class of person who needs to be treated with kid gloves, some of them are the kind of person that will end up abusing because they think they can act with impunity. They think that there is nobody that will ever bring them down. And then, of course, Jimmy Savile would have had a lot of friends, not just in the media. He'd had friends in policing. He'd have friends in other institutions, which he will then have pressured in some way, shape, or form to keep him from the public, ultimately from justice. So, we've got to recognize. I always used to say this, I didn't care what the name on the front of the file was. If it was Jimmy Savile or HRH or whatever it may be, it mattered not. What mattered was the evidence. And that is why we call our podcast. That's why we call our podcast Without Fear or Favor, because that is the basis of our justice system, ought to be anyway. That it doesn't matter who they are, you don't make special favors, and you're not fearful of any consequences. You just follow the evidence.
What was the fallout, Nazir, in the CPS after
massive? Because it also tied in with the Rochdale case, which I dealt with. We introduced brand new guidelines for sexual abuse of children, for prosecuting sexual abuse of children. We brought in national training, which we never had before. We had specialist prosecutors, which we never had before. We started looking again at cases that previously had been decided that we shouldn't prosecute. Cases like Jeff Savile's case, where we looked again at the evidence, for example. So we reopened many more cases. It was seismic. The world of 2013, when all these changes were brought in, did not resemble the world of 2012 or before that. And, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Within that 2-year period, Mark, we went from being pretty rubbish to having the highest conviction rate for sexual abuse of children in British history. And that's because Savile, Rochdale, the Utrecht cases and many others that people are aware of changed the landscape of child protection.
Let's talk a little bit about Rochdale, because Rochdale goes to the heart of individuals not being prosecuted. And some of the attitudes, I mean, I remember reading the report in relation to the social worker who'd talked in terms of, was it a 12 or 13-year-old, consenting to sex and that being okay. I mean, where on earth does an individual working in children's services, all the authorities, think that that remotely is acceptable?
It isn't. It never is and never could be. But the landscape that existed prior to Rochdale and prior to Savile was one where if a victim had to look a certain... I used to say, you know, not all victims come out of a nunnery. You know, they often have chaotic trouble backgrounds. They often are involved in low-level criminality. They often are in the care system, whatever it may be, or approved schools, as in Savile's case. But that the reason then that they are targeted by the perpetrator is because the perpetrator knows where the victims are and the fact that the authorities won't pay any attention towards them. But the landscape that existed prior to 2011, 2012, Mark, was one where if you had anything in your background as a victim that might in some way damage your credibility, then they didn't even bother. And that could just be the fact that you're in the care system, you know? And of course, the only people that were happy with that decision or that choice was the victim, perpetrator. Because the perpetrator, I mean, I'll give you a good example. Did you know until 2012, the police did not know where care homes were because of apparently data protection. Now, the only people who knew where the care homes were the perpetrators who were sat outside in their cars. You know, so the bad guys knew where the victims were. The police did not know where the potential victims were.
And you know, and furthermore, and in addition to that, the police had no proper record of the amount of children that were missing from care homes.
Yeah,
they
absolutely
had no idea where those children were and where they'd gone missing. That is shocking.
Didn't care. These were the unheard. Savile's victims were the same. They were the unheard. They were the unlistened to. They were the ignored. And what we did.
It's the vulnerable again, isn't it? It's the vulnerable. The vulnerable are the people. If we target policing to look after the most vulnerable, you reduce the level of crime. It's a simple process.
If you close the door, they won't burgle. You know, or try. It'd be harder for them to burgle. You know, so but we have a system, or we did have a system, and to some extent it's back again, I'm afraid, where some people are above the law, where some people feel that they can change the law if you're in Parliament to avoid consequences. And it's shocking, really, because I felt, and I still believe, and I know you do, that 68 million people in this country should have the same justice system, should have the same ability to be report their crimes, and every crime that they report should be treated in the same way.
Well, no, I always say so many times, is no one victim is more worthy than another. We are all exactly the same. It doesn't matter whether you're a working girl or whether you're a young black boy. You deserve exactly the same care.
The strange as it may sound, the biggest victims of rape in this country are sex workers. And I only heard that from English Collective of Prostitutes about 20 years ago when I was meeting with them. And they said to me, do you know that we are the group of people that will suffer more rapes than anywhere else?
Yeah.
And when I heard that, I thought, you know something? I've never prosecuted the rape of a sex worker. And yet the data was absolutely right. They were the biggest victims. Because people made assumptions that unless you were... unless you were of a certain type of person in a certain place doing a certain job, whatever it may be, with a certain household and a certain background, you couldn't possibly be a victim.
Yeah. It's that, you know, it's that attitude that comes from the 70s, the 80s, misogyny that still exists. Let me just talk, because I think it is, you know, one of the things between us is that we will go anywhere. We'll talk about anything. We're not frightened of talking about some of those things. The Rochdale. So ethnicity played a massive part as far as the fallout of Rochdale. Just talk us through that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the nine men that we prosecuted were, initially anyway, were British Pakistani or British Afghani, and the girls that The women who gave evidence, or girls that gave evidence at that time, were British white girls. So the assumption was, and it was one that was exploited by the far right, was that this was brown people, minorities, attacking our white girls. What they did not pay much attention to was that I subsequently prosecuted the ringleader, for example, for his abuse of an Asian girl, that there were victims from other minorities also, that there were, you know, at the same time as the Rostow case, I prosecuted a gang of 10 white men who'd been abusing girls in Harrogate in North Yorkshire. But that, you know, that got a paragraph in the Daily Mail. Right. The point is, you know, the media will do what it does. There's no getting away from it. You know, they whatever interests people. And you know, the reality is, the ethnicity of those men is an issue, but it wasn't the issue. The issue is what you and I have already just discussed. That is, there is a segment of society who will not get justice, who did not get justice because they were not believed. And I think that's what we put right in Rochdale, or tried to. That's what you put right subsequently in relation to Savile. And that's what we've tried to put right since, although, as we touched on earlier in earlier podcasts, resources have had a massive impact on the ability to do that.
There's a huge shift in attitudes as a result of Savile, Rochdale, and the fallout from them. But where do you think we are now?
We took a massive step back because we lost the specialist teams, we lost the experience, funding was taken away from children's services, social services, and I think over the last 2 or 3 years, the powerful have suddenly felt that they're able to get away with more than they previously could. So I think we're in a bad place right now, actually, Mark. As we speak, you know, people are saying, well, you know, if you're of a certain class of person, you'll never face justice. If you're a class of victim, you won't be heard. But we know, we all know, not just the two of us, what works. What works is specialist teams, experienced teams, ring fence budgets, starting and first and foremost with listening to and believing the victim. And unfortunately, you know, I'm, hand on heart, I don't think we're in a good place right now.
And follow your instincts. You know, one of the things that I always say, and I'm passionate about what I do, like you, you know, when I get set off on a task, off I go to go and do something, I will keep going. You know, no matter how hard it is, you know, I will find a way to get that so that I can try and get some justice for victims. And as investigators, we owe it to do as much as we can and more. You know, I will do absolutely everything. And it does impact on us. I don't think there's any doubt that the work that we've done, and I probably see it more now than I ever have done. You know, I'm in my 50s, and I think there's been more acknowledgement more recently from myself that it has had an impact on me, on all the work and the horrible cases we've dealt with. And have you felt the same?
You know, I think back to 25 years ago when I dealt with a case involving a family where a father raped his 18-month-old baby whilst the mother filmed it. And I had to watch the video before the trial, as preparing the trial. I've never forgotten that. 25 years ago, very recently, there was a case in which a man was convicted of the murder of two women in the 80s. But also based on videos found and evidence found at his home address, that he'd been interfering sexually with 71 women's bodies in a mortuary. Can you begin to think what it must be like for the police officers and prosecutors dealing with that case? And the jury, in fact, who might have to hear the evidence. You know, I don't think we're in a place, quite frankly, where we realize the impact of dealing with these cases has on the professionals.
And we didn't at the time. You know, I've watched hundreds of hours of child abuse material, and I can tell you some of it still sits in my head now. You know, if there's music, certain types of music on, or if there's a scene, I did some recent filming in Germany for the Madeleine investigation. I went to a location and it rung bells of a video that I'd seen of a child horrifically being abused. And it came right back to the forefront. And as I've cut the program, I've seen that scene quite a few times, and I talk about it. And it's one of those things that I don't think ever goes away. But in a way, whilst it affects us to a degree, it also drives me. It makes me passionate about saying, do you know what? I'm going to do everything I can to stop that from happening. But there is a knock-on effect. I think there is. Yeah. It gone are the days when I was in the job and you were in the Crown Prosecution Service. I mean, I never got any counselling. I mean, I went to see a counsellor I wasn't even a counsellor. When I was doing a murder inquiry, before I started another murder inquiry, at the end of my service, I had to go and see someone to talk to them. And I just simply went and had a cup of tea and a biscuit. But I didn't really understand what that was all about. Now, there is some proper care, but it does impact.
No. There's a personal cost, which I think people need to recognize. And as you just indicated, unless you offer therapy, unless you offer counseling, proper therapy, then you're creating a problem amongst the professionals dealing with these cases because they're burdened with it, as you and I have been. We recognize, and I think I'm glad you made the point, actually, that it actually drives us. It's what we've seen and heard over the years has made us even more emboldened to do something about it. And keeps us motivated when we feel perhaps it's too much. We shouldn't be in that position, to be honest, because we should have got some care and support back then. But I'm hopeful that people working in the job now or working in the prosecution service now will get a little bit more help.
There's something I always say, and I know that we've both got to go, but I'll just leave with this thought, is that I remember somebody saying to me once, does it affect you? And I said, because a number of people are saying, it doesn't affect me to look at all these pictures. And my response is, the day that it stops affecting me is the day I walk away from doing this job, because of course it upsets me. How could I watch an image of somebody being killed or a child being sexually abused and not let it upset me? I mean, we, as technology moves on, we started to film crime scenes. And I remember seeing a double murder where this person was executed, shot in the head with a pillow. And I remember the investigating force, because it wasn't our force. We dealt with an element of it and they sent the video down for us to watch. And I remember watching that and I can still see it vividly now. I can still see that. And it does impact. And I think, the moment as investigators, we say that it doesn't affect us is the moment we should stop.
The moment we stop and let somebody else do it. You're right.
Next week, we're going to talk around the aspects of technology and policing and how it's changed so much. The tools of a police officer today is very different to the tools that they had 5, 10, 15 years ago. And from a prosecution's point of view, it's exactly the same.
Absolutely. I mean, crime does not look like what it looked like 25 years ago. And therefore, police and prosecutors need to respond to that. The question is whether they're responding fast enough.
So we're going to have a look at some of the areas of crime, how it's changed, and also touch on some of those cases which drill home how different policing is. And the problem that police officers have now is that the demand is phenomenal, but the response doesn't keep up with the demand.
No, absolutely not.
Brilliant. Nazir, as ever, you're a star. Take care. Look after yourself.
Good to speak to you, Mark.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then do send us an email. Get in contact. We'll reply to everything. I hope you're enjoying it and we'll see you next week. Take care. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.